Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today we're going to be talking about a concept called revolutionary intercommunality. And we're going to be speaking with Tom Watts. And Tom is a former 60s activist and White Panther. Today he is an elder advisor to the prison-based United Panther Movement, led by the new African Black Panther Party prison chapter. He is an editor-publisher at Rising Sun Press and lives in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Tom Watts, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Oh, thank you, Cindy.
Well, that went well for my first time. Well, the reason I asked you to be on, first of all, we're friends on Facebook, and I always appreciate your very thoughtful and revolutionary comments when you bring everything that we're talking about to the reality of the situation, that it's not a problem of the Democrats or the Republicans, it's a problem of capitalism and imperialism.
Right.
And so the thing that attracted me to interviewing you this week is you sent me something you wrote about a revolutionary intercommunalism. And it's based in a philosophy that was created by the Black Panther Party and Comrade Huey Newton. And sometimes when people think of the Black Panther Party, they think of just violent, almost anarchist, but they actually had a very revolutionary Marxist-Leninist way of analyzing things and the way of attacking the problems, not by violence, but by by this revolutionary analysis. And first, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the 10-point program of the Black Panther Party.
Okay. Well, the 10-point program was what the Panthers started around, and it's like a laundry list of things that are wrong, you know, from housing to the way the court systems are run, to, you know, the basics that human beings need of land, food, clothing, which are being denied to a majority of the people in the world right now.
Right. Well, and so, like I said, they analyze the problems and attack them. They didn't do it in a way that was, spontaneous. Sometimes you have to react, but they weren't reactionary. They were revolutionary. And they based a lot of their theory, at least what I've been reading about Comrade Newton, on Marxist dialectical materialism. Can you tell my listeners a little bit about that and how the Black Panthers used it to analyze the problems of their day, which are actually the problems still of our day?
Okay. Well, there's basically two ways of looking at the world. One is the idealist way, where you formulate an idea and then you use that to explain everything. The other is the materialist way of looking at the world as it actually is and trying to get a reflection of that in your mind based on investigation and study. It's a more scientific way of looking at things. And dialectics is the understanding that everything exists as a unity of opposites, that there's an internal struggle going on in everything all the time. That movement is what we call life, you know. And that out of that struggle between opposites, things transform.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like you want to quit smoking. Part of you wants to quit, part of you doesn't. And there's a struggle going on as to whether you're going to end up being a smoker for life or a non-smoker.
Right.
And in this society, the struggle takes the form of classes, that there's a ruling class that owns most of everything, and a working class that does all the labor and makes life possible. And between those two classes, there's a struggle. But the working class doesn't need a ruling class.
Right.
The working class can democratically decide how to do things for its common interest. Whereas the exploiting class needs a class to exploit. So, you know, there is an end to the class struggle, and that is when the masses of people take the power into their own hands and eliminate a ruling class, which eliminates really all classes. And then
right.
instead of being a class society, we become a human society.
Well, and then this struggle between the classes, you sent me or you referenced me to a speech that Comrade Huey Newton gave at Boston College on November 18th, 1970. And to me, that was a very prophetic speech that he gave. But he talked about something that I think is more of a problem today than it was back then. And that's technocracy and the unemployables, the lumpen proletariat. Can you talk about how in revolutionary intercommunality, the lumpen proletariat is involved?
Okay, well, one difference between Newton's theory and Marx's was Marx saw the working class as producing with a labor-intensive economy, where most of the people would be working
right.
in factories and in production. But what technology has done is it's created a revolution where fewer and fewer people are needed to produce the things that we need. Factories that used to have thousands of people now have dozens of people operating, automated assembly lines and
mm-hmm.
packaging and all that. Ships, when they come into harbor, now it's a few people operating cranes that pull containers off and load them onto trains or whatever. Whereas it used to be thousands of people unloading the ship by hand and loading it onto trucks and stuff.
Right.
So what we have is a situation where a majority of people have become surplus to the interests of the capitalists. They can't exploit them for money.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, there's like a war on the poor going on. Whereas they don't want us, they don't want to feed us, we don't want to find non-productive work, such as, doing counseling or, teaching art or something,
Right.
To them, that's totally non-productive. Whereas in a socialist society, we could take the advantage of that situation and have more and more people doing things they would like to do and getting a pay for it, as opposed to just producing to make a profit.
Mm-hmm. And so they envisioned the lumpen proletariat as leading the revolution.
Well, lumpen means, it's a German word meaning broken.
Mm-hmm.
There's a negative connotation to the lumpen because people are forced to do things like rob banks and deal drugs because they can't find any work.
Right.
But in reality, most people would rather be doing something they think is socially constructive. That's why a lot of the people that become radicalized in prison were formerly drug dealers or some kind of gangster, And, you know, when they have the chance to reflect and to think about it, they realize that they were forced into it by a social system that has no room for them, no place for them. So Malcolm X said a lot of the numbers runners could have been, you know, great mathematicians because they do everything in their head.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no, you know, place for them in that society. And, you know, but a lot of lumping their hustles are not really that. Like the guy that was choked in New York City by the police that choked him to death.
Right.
He was selling cigarettes singly. You know, where you buy a pack of cigarettes and then you sell them one at a time for a dollar.
Uh-huh.
No big crime, really. But, you know, enough for the police to stop him, harass him, and kill him. You know, people have other hustles like, you know, selling, you know, incense or, you know, well, you know, I'm sure you've been on the street seeing people selling all kinds of stuff.
Right.
They're classified as lumping because they're not part of the greater economy.
Well, I've also been in jail with people like that.
Yeah. And they're lumping, not bad people.
They're in jail because they're just trying to survive. And
right.
Like you said, there's no place for them in this society and no other way for them to do it. So what are they supposed to do? Just starve?
Right. I mean, when you get down to it, it's like what woman wouldn't go out and, you know, sell herself on the street if it meant not seeing her baby starve to death?
Right.
I remember one day I read in the paper there were two people arrested, went before the same alderman, and got the same bail, which was, you know, $100,000, whatever. One of them had stolen a pair of children's shoes, and another had embezzled, you know, $500,000 from the steel company.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
And think about it. The guy who embezzled, you know, $500,000 or whatever, probably was making a huge salary and was just being greedy. Whereas the guy stealing the shoes probably had a kid whose feet were hurting because he'd outgrown his shoes. You know, and he had felt no other alternative but to try to satisfy his responsibility as a parent to provide.
Right, it's, you know, just terrible.
You know, if I was hungry enough, I would steal. Mm-hmm. I would, you know, go to the grocery store and grab something.
Right, exactly. Put an apple in your pocket or something. So,
yeah.
The Black Panther Party, when I was studying this concept of revolutionary communality, they said that they consider themselves a nationalist party, but then they if they were nationalists, that meant that they were also internationalists, but then they figured that they're really under empire, that's not really possible to do. So instead of nationalism, they thought that there were liberated communities within the structural framework of empire. So they transformed their thinking into revolutionary intercommunality. I don't know if I'm saying that right. And
yeah.
And instead of reactionary intercommunality, can you talk about, this is why I wanted to talk to you about this notion. If it was an empire in 1970, then it's even more so today in 2014.
Right.
So can you talk about that, the concept, and where we can take it today to, you know, create this revolutionary, the revolutionary communities that we need to make classless societies?
Right. Well, the essence of Huey's thinking was that really a nation as such is impossible in today's world. That the United States is not a nation anymore, it's an empire.
Mm-hmm.
Out of 190-some countries in the world, we have military bases in over 150 of them.
Right.
That's the most globe-reaching empire that history has ever seen. It makes Rome look like a parochial affair, you know.
Exactly.
There's been a demand for black people to have their own nation. And it goes back to the 1920s and the Garvey movement and all that. And there was a time back then when you could take the Black Belt South and make it an independent nation.
Right.
Because black people were concentrated that much in a geographic area. But today that's not even possible. Everybody's all mixed together. And people want to be mixed together for the most part. We pretty much everybody on the planet in their heart knows that racism and separation are bad things. That it's better for everybody to, you know, be accepted as an individual and, you know, treated the same way. And what they realized in 1970 was that talking about being a nation was not reflecting reality. It wasn't being materialistic. It was being idealistic. It was mm-hmm. taking an idea and trying to make it fit reality,
right,
rather than looking at reality. And, you know, so what Huey saw, too, with the liberation struggles in Africa was that they didn't lead to becoming independent socialist states. It led to neocolonialism, where you have a black face in the government, but in reality, the economy is run by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and corporate, investment that are bleeding the country of its national resources. And that's, you saw that as reactionary communalism,
mm-hmm.
communalism, where empire, even though it's different than like the British Empire, it's an empire of capital.
Right.
That any country you go to has the same banks, the same Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, McDonald's.
Starbucks.
Yeah.
Every country has a Starbucks now, except Cuba.
Yeah, except for, and the way Huey defined countries like Cuba is as a temporary liberated zone, where for whatever reason a certain amount of nationalism is allowed because it's defended with, the might of a whole country in their will,
mm-hmm.
like North Korea.
Right.
North Korea is poor because it spends the vast majority of its money being an independent country. You know, it's armed to the teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only basis that it's not completely overrun by U.S. imperialism the way South Korea has been. So revolutionary communalism is turning that into its opposite and doing away with the boundaries in a positive way. Not, it's like we have a boundary between the U.S. and Mexico in a negative way.
Uh-huh.
Apple can cross the boundary whenever it wants, but people have a harder time.
Exactly.
You know, but there's, under revolutionary communalism, your goal would be, we'll call it dictatorship of the proletariat, which just means that the working class holds the reins of power in order to transform society. And the goal would be to create a world where whatever country you go to has basically the same standard of living, where everybody has an equal access to, the things that they need. And when you've got that accomplished, you can move on to communism, which is no government. It's just a system where, you know, people work, people get what they need, and there's no war. You know, there's no armies or, you know, no prisons. Everything is dealt with on a, you know, communal level. It's like communities have been around. Community is really the basis of how we live together. Nation is like an invented thing of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
But people have been living in communities since we came down out of the trees. And problems are resolved in a community. But intercommunalism is just taking that to a world level, where you have communities within communities within communities. And, for example, the lesbian gay community is part of the communities that we all live in. And the black community is part of a community we all live in, you know, whatever color we are. There's a white community, a black community, a Spanish community, a Chinese community, a Filipino community. People are gathered together by religion. You have the Christians, the Muslims, the Hindus, the Buddhists. They're all communities. But where capitalism plays them against each other, revolutionary intercommunalism nurtures the solidarity between them. You know, you believe in, you know, Hinduism, and I believe in Buddhism, but let's no skin off either of our noses, you know.
Right.
We can both be neighbors and, you know, friendly and cooperate, even though we don't agree about everything. And we have other communities that meet those needs, you know, like the car club community. You know, people that like to fix up old cars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have their own community within the overall community. And that's all a positive thing if it's approached from a revolutionary perspective. Where it becomes negative is when exploitation comes in. And then, you know, one community is considered better than the other community and more privileged. You know, people shouldn't be privileged because, you know, they're white or they belong to the right religion or, you know, whatever.
Or two-legged animals are better than four-legged animals.
Right.
Taking an animal farm analogy. So, the Black Panther Party was also very interested, you know, in the vanguard of integrating theory with practice. So, how do we integrate this theory into practice today to create these revolutionary communities?
Well, we think the 10-point program is still an applicable program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are suffering out of, you know, basic denial of basic survival needs. So by organizing communities around those survival needs, you build political power at the grassroots level. For example, one of the most popular programs the Black Panthers had was the Free Breakfast for Children.
Right.
Well, in the last 20 years, child malnutrition has skyrocketed in this country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's up 14-15%. You know, that's kids that aren't getting enough nutrition for their brains and bodies to develop properly. And that can be addressed by things like a Free Breakfast for Children program, where kids get a nice, nutritious breakfast before going to school. Or you can even have a free dinner program, you know, for kids coming out of school. You can have soup kitchens, you know. There's no limit to the programs a community can create independent of the state.
Well, and no matter the difficulties with religion and that old evangelist, Amy Semple McPherson, she had soup kitchens at her temple in Los Angeles because she says people can't hear the gospel if they have empty stomachs. You know, people can't I think it would be easier to radicalize people and lead people, not lead people, that's not what I meant, teach people or instruct people if their physical needs were taken care of first.
Right, you can't think about politics when your stomach is empty.
Right, the politics of a grumbly tummy. Yeah. So, Tom, is there anything else that you'd like to add that, you know, I haven't asked you, or something that you think is relevant to our conversation?
Well, I just want to go back to your original point about the impression people have of the Panthers being violent. The Panthers believed in self-defense.
Right.
And it wasn't that they were aggressively going out doing violent things. They were reacting to the police, you know, treatment of people in the black community. Like right now, we're aware that cops are shooting down people all over the place because we now have cell phones and we have social media.
Right.
That this stuff has been going on for a long time. And the Panthers, you know, like you could see pictures, you know, of, you know, their free breakfast program with bullet holes all over the doors and stuff. That was how the police responded to organizing in the black community. And the Panthers looked at it like, well, there's one, either we can give up the idea of organizing or we can take up arms to protect the people from the police. And they chose the latter. And that was used as an excuse to demonize them and portray them in the media as being violent.
Right.
But really, it was the police that were being violent and are violent all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we have to, like, ask, well, why are the police being violent all the time? And it can only be because that's what the ruling class wants.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they'd be being purged like crazy.
Exactly. There'd be some accountability. Yeah. They'd be getting fired or put in prison for their violence.
Right. Yeah. Like you go over to England, they have a separate prison just for police that abuse their power.
Wow.
You know, so that when you become a cop, you realize that if you get caught doing something illegal, you're going to go to prison quicker than the average citizen.
And that's the way it should be. Except here in the United States, most of the law enforcement, they have what they call the Law Enforcement Bill of Rights, which gives them more rights than we have. To me, they should have more accountability.
Yeah. And that's because we have such an unequal society. I mean, most people don't even realize how unequal it is. But you can put all of the people that own the majority of wealth in the world on one tour bus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that few, there's that much concentration of wealth and power. So that, you know, you could say everybody's vote counts the same. It's true, it counts for nothing.
That's a really good point.
You know, it's like, you know, you can run for office in California.
Like I did.
You have a legal right to do that.
Uh-huh.
But who's going to be the governor of California isn't going to be decided by that election.
Right.
It's going to be decided by the financial interests that run California.
I saw a crazy meme on Facebook yesterday that said, if you don't vote for Democrats, then the corporations will run our country. I'm like, that happens no matter if you vote or not.
Right.
That's going to happen. So.
I was on WBAI for an interview one time. And, you know, WBAI is a very progressive,
right,
you know, so-called radical station.
Pacifica, right? It's Pacifica in New York, yeah.
And so I asked, you know, the host and the other guests, who does the Fortune 500 give the most money to? You know, if you aggregate them, you know. Who do they give the most money to, the Republicans or Democrats? And everybody, without hesitation, said, oh, the Republicans. I said, no, they don't. They divide it down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
they win no matter who gets elected.
Absolutely. And we lose no matter who gets elected.
No matter who gets elected.
Yeah.
So this idea of choosing the lesser evil is, you know, the straight road to hell, you know. If you go through life choosing the lesser evil, you're going to end up having nothing but evil.
As we do. And Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report says, don't ever call Obama the lesser of two evils. He's the greater, or he's the more effective evil.
Right. Exactly. That's why they picked him.
Exactly.
And, you know, they'll run Sarah Palin and McCain on the opposite simply because they want to make Obama look good.
Right. So, Tom Watts, with your permission, I'll reprint the article you sent me that you wrote about revolutionary intercommunality. And I thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. If people have further questions, is there a way that they could get a hold of you?
Well, they can find me on Facebook.
All righty, and I'll post your Facebook, your Facebook page on the newsletter, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Okay. Tom Watts, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox today. I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate this, to me, very interesting and relevant chat we had today.
Okay, thank you, Cindy.
Thank you. See you on Facebook.
Okay.
Well, that's Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox for today. I hope you found it as interesting and educational as I did. And if you'd like more information on revolutionary intercommunality, you can look up Huey Newton's speech at Boston College on November 18th, 1970. And Tom Watts's piece on the subject will be posted at the Soapbox People's Network with a link on our newsletter and at the Soapbox People's Network. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, my production assistant, Dee Dee Miller, and my occasional assistant, Mikey. I'd like to thank Tom Watts for his work and for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And as always, I'd especially like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.